Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the grueling five-hour meeting today of British Prime Minister Theresa May's cabinet, where she eventually managed to get them to sign on to her unpopular and incoherent Brexit plan, which now has to face a sceptical parliament. Joining us from the UK is Polly Toynbee, a columnist for The Guardian, where she has an article, Theresa May's Brexit Deal Solves Nothing. Open warfare is about to begin. We'll discuss May's shaky governing coalition with a razor-thin majority, which relies on the support of the far-right Northern Ireland Democratic Unionist Party of hardline Brexiteers, who are not likely to compromise. Then, assuming she can quell the infighting in her own ranks, she must then get at least 30 Labour MPs to defect, which is highly unlikely. In fact, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, will probably push for a no-confidence vote on a plan that, after 28 months of agonised wrangling, Corbyn is now denouncing as May's false choice between, quote, a botched deal and no deal. And if this political zombie finally collapses under its own weight of dishonesty and delusion, May's government will fall and a general election will be called. Meanwhile, the deadline for the 28 member countries of the EU who are waiting to vote to ratify May's plan is only weeks away. Then we will look into reports that President Trump is sulking in the White House and lashing out at skittish White House aides while he mulls over who to fire with his Homeland Security advisor and his chief of staff first in line on the chopping block. Writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist Chris Whipple, the author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every President, joins us to discuss an already dysfunctional White House going further off the rails as infighting escalates, with even the First Lady now deciding who gets to serve on the National Security Council. Then finally, with Senators McConnell and Schumer being re-elected to their Senate leadership positions and Kevin McCarthy, the new Republican House Minority Leader, we will assess the fate of Nancy Pelosi and whether she will be the next Speaker of the House. John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, and author of The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship, joins us. He worked in the House for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff, and we will discuss how the new crop of younger idealistic members, similar to the class of 74, might vote for Speaker since many of them distanced themselves from Pelosi during the campaign. And joining us now from London is Polly Toynbee, a columnist for The Guardian, who was formerly the BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and Associate Editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. She's the co-author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. And her latest article at The Guardian is Theresa May's Brexit Deal Solves Nothing. Open warfare is about to begin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Polly Toynbee.
Hello.
Well, thank you for staying up. I know you've had a long day, and it's been a very critical day in the UK with Theresa May trying to sell her Brexit plan to her cabinet. So where do we stand at this moment?
Well, she's got over the first hurdle. Just, it took her 5 hours to persuade her own cabinet, with many rumours of possible resignations, many people who threatened to resign. But she survived resignations in the past. She lost a foreign secretary. She's lost a Brexit secretary. So I guess she would have survived that too. But I imagine it was a pretty bruising and grueling cabinet session. But she came out. They agreed. And now she has the biggest hurdle of all. She has to get it through our parliament. Well, she has to get it through 27 other countries to agree. They probably will. Our parliament almost certainly won't.
But she has a very, very shaky coalition and an extremely thin margin in the House. And a part of a coalition are the hard right unionists from Northern Ireland who want a hard Brexit. Has she managed to keep them in line?
Not tonight. They are very good at barking loudly and extracting large sums of money out of her. But so they may cave in at the last moment. But as things stand tonight, they are saying they cannot sign up to this deal. It's visceral for them. It's a blood issue. It's a fundamental constitutional issue about Northern Ireland not being tied to Ireland, but being part, an equal part of the United Kingdom. and anything that seems to suggest they have a different status offends them mortally. That's where they are now. She may bring them round with something or another, but as it stands, that's 10 votes lost, and she has no majority. But much more serious, in a way, is the extraordinary coalition that has gathered from the two sides who really hate each other, the anti-Brexit people and the very strong Brexiteers. And they have all united, and they all have the same critique, surprisingly, of her deal. They all say, you promised us this would bring back control to the sovereign British Parliament. It does the opposite. This is a deal where we lose control, where we are entirely under the control of Brussels, who can dictate what rules, what regulations we must obey, and we will no longer have a seat at the table in Brussels. We'll no longer have our own members of the European Parliament. We will be vassals, and both sides have used that rather quaint feudal phrase.
But surely, though, just touching on Northern Ireland, sharing a border, of course, with the Republic of Ireland, which is a part of the EU, that in itself creates enormous problems, does it not? And so it seems like the Good Friday Agreement is in jeopardy.
It is very much in jeopardy. The Good Friday Agreement really only worked because of the close collaboration of North and South, their governments agreeing to be the guarantors of it. Of course, the DUP, who are the most extreme unionists, never supported the Good Friday Agreement anyway. And although they say they want a soft border, there's a suspicion they wouldn't much mind if a wall went up. They are blaming the South, they're blaming Ireland for making trouble with this deal. They're not Good Friday agreeers in the first place. So this makes it considerably harder. It gives them some pleasure to try and uproot it.
But conversely, the majority of Northern Irelanders voted to remain in the Brexit vote, did they not?
Indeed. The DUP does not represent the majority in Ireland. They just happen to be the ones who are in coalition with Theresa May and propping up her government. The tragedy is that Sinn Féin have 7 MPs, but they never take their seat in Westminster. They are sworn not to. They stand on a platform saying we will never go to Westminster. They refuse to acknowledge the status of Northern Ireland. And there have been many people who hope that perhaps on this one occasion they might gallop over the hill as white knights to the rescue of the majority in Northern Ireland who want to remain and vote that way, and they could swing it. But Irish politics are not the same as everybody else's politics, and they are obdurate. Everybody in Ireland is always obdurate.
Well, what I find extraordinary about Brexit, and I think a lot of people here in the United States looking across the Atlantic, wondering how this ever happened in the first place. The people who sold it seemed such a motley group, and it's created nothing but problems. It's so obvious that it's a complete millstone politically, and nobody is happy, right? It doesn't seem like at this point anybody is happy with it, and I always wonder why you just can't, in the UK, they can't just bite the bullet and have a quick do-over and sort of pretend this whole agony didn't happen. Is that...
Any sane person looking at us from all over the world would say the same. What are they doing? This is an act of beating ourselves up all by ourselves, an act of immense self-harm and damage for no particular reason. You find members of the government or members of the Tory party can say we have to stand together as if we were in a war or a natural disaster. You say, hang on a minute, this isn't a war or a natural disaster. It's an insane thing we have decided to do to ourselves. The rest of Europe look on, aghast, possibly laughing a bit. We are figures of fun. It is an embarrassment. But here we are. How did it happen? Well, it's been a small virus within an extreme part of the Conservative Party that has been festering away for about 40 years. And they've got bigger and bigger and stronger and stronger. And each successive Conservative leader has given way to them just a little bit more, given them just a bit more. Until finally, act of absolute madness, David Cameron said, all right, we'll have a referendum. And he put it in his manifesto for the general election. And as a result, felt he had to then carry it out. It was partly because UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, was beginning, small, very small party that never won a single seat in Westminster, was beginning to chip away at considerable chunks of Conservative votes around the country, so that although they'd never win a seat themselves, they could make sure that Conservatives lost seats to Labour or Liberal Democrats. So they felt like a real threat, even though now they barely exist. So for these reasons, successive Conservative leaders have never talked up Europe, never explained to anybody why Europe is such a positive, and now it's an uphill struggle to remind people what good it's done us.
So open warfare, that will be largely in the House of Commons. Is that how you see it?
Well, within the House of Commons, most particularly within the Conservative Party. Tonight, the story is that a number of the most extreme Brexiters within the Conservative Party are sending letters to the party organiser calling for a no-confidence vote in her. If he gets 48%, if he gets 48 of those letters from 48 backbenchers, Conservative backbenchers, he is obliged to call a vote of no confidence. She then has to win 158 of her own MPs to back her. She probably would, but it would still be a very damaging thing to her reputation. On the other hand, she seems to survive any amount of humiliation and battering about. She springs back again. Perhaps she would survive even that. I doubt they would have 158 MPs who would try to decapitate her at this stage. After all, what a time to hold a leadership election in the middle of these last few crucial months before we have to decide what to do when we are destined to leave Europe on the 29th of March. That's a very short time. If we want to turn it round, if we want to change our minds, it's not a good time to be changing your party leader.
Well, when you mention humiliation, maybe Theresa May is something of a masochist. I mean, she put up with an abusive phone call from President Trump. She called up President Trump to congratulate him on his election successes, which are now not looking so successful. And apparently he was quite abusive to her. What's the reaction in the UK?
I don't know, but it's true that her one great strength is her sticking power. That whatever anybody says, whatever anybody does, she is not diverted from her course in the sense that she stays there. However, she did have to make an important decision about which side would she go with. And her decision to go with the right of her party and not the left of her party has been a pretty disastrous one. But she does seem relatively impervious. I think she's never had many friends. She's never had personal friends in the party. She's never had a group in the party. She got this job really to everybody's amazement because she was the last one standing in a very peculiar non-election after David Cameron stood down rapidly. And so she stands there alone and friendless, but somehow resolute and somehow impervious to insult, which is possibly a necessary attribute of a leader.
So is that what you mean in your article, One Day We Wonder How These Brexit Fanatics Seize the Nation, when you say Theresa May chose to ride the tiger of her party instead of protecting the interests of her country? Is she going to go down with the ship? I mean, her job is to be the Prime Minister, the leader of the United Kingdom. How could somebody be so distracted not to see the big picture?
She's not a big picture person. She's a step-by-step sort of person. She doesn't have much strategy. She certainly has no vision. I think she leant towards those people who put most pressure on her. She was herself a not very enthusiastic Remainer and took very little, small part in the referendum campaign, as if she was rather reluctant Remainer. I don't think her heart is in it on either side, really, but she plods on. I think that she's made such big strategic errors. After all, 48.5% of people in this country voted to remain. She should have said, this is such a divisive issue that we must do this in the softest possible way. We must have a Brexit deal, where we stay in the customs union, where we stay in the single market, where we stay as close to our neighbours as possible. We obey the instruction of the referendum. But, of course, nobody knows what people voted for, whether they voted for a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit. They were promised all manner of things during the campaign. She could have gone that way and would possibly have garnered quite a lot of support from other parties. She might not now be all on her own in the way that she is.
But the Labour Party, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has never been a profile in courage when it comes to Brexit. When it originally happened, he sort of tried to be on the fence, and now he seems to be waffling as well. And, of course, as you point out, the headcounters say that Theresa May needs at least 30 Labour MPs to defect. So what is Corbyn's position, if indeed you can give us an update if it changes?
Well, the position is that, as on almost every policy you care to mention, he made his mind up in 1970 and has never really changed his mind about anything. Flexible is not in his nature much either. Uh-huh. But I think things have moved on. I think he's really reached the point where it is quite clear that the great majority of his voters, the great majority of his party, of his MPs, are all passionate Remainers. He is an eccentric lever for old-fashioned ideas that, well, this is a capitalist club and you can't really do state aid and socialist things while you're in it. But I think that's really faded away. I think at last everybody has persuaded him to concentrate on the one thing that oppositions do, which is to oppose. He has a golden opportunity here to cause serious damage to a government that is detested by the Labour Party, who has imposed severe austerity on this country over the last 8 years. And this is his one great chance. And he was very good in the House of Commons today. He really took her on Brexit for the first time and walloped her all over the place, and she looked uncomfortable. And I think he's now at last getting the message from nearly all those around him that this is his job, this is his task. He must save us from Brexit if he can, but certainly do all he can to damage the government, because he's the opposition.
Well, there's a very alarming article in today's New York Times, Polly Toynbee, pointing out that one-fifth of the population in the UK lives below the poverty line. I find that astounding. Is that sort of generating political activism? Is that, in other words, is there a sense that a fifth of the country living in poverty is connected with the Tory party's austerity?
Well, we've had severe inequality problems for a long time, ever since the 1980s. Mrs. Thatcher, the lid came off at the top, and the people and a lot of the people at the bottom were pushed down. We have never recovered from an explosion of inequality in that time. And although when Labour was in power, they brought in a lot of tax credits, a much better benefit system. They lifted 1 million children out of poverty and 1 million pensioners out of poverty. The austerity since then has cast all that back. I can't pretend that it's a new phenomenon, but this has certainly sent us back where so many children are actually hungry, and food banks are opening up all over the place, even in rich areas, which has really shocked people. We've never had food banks before. And most of the people going to them are actually in work, but too low paid, and they've had their benefits, their tax credits cut that would support a family to bring them up to a reasonable living standard. This is a very, very serious problem. We are one of the most unequal countries in Europe, and the latest budget has hit hard again, with no sign of any let-up on this. We are closer to America than to Europe, really, in the shape of our distribution of wealth and income.
So just in closing, Polly Toynbee, let's turn to the only apparent beneficiary of Brexit so far, and that is Vladimir Putin, if indeed it's a part of his strategy to divide Europe and weaken the EU. He certainly had enablers, if indeed Nigel Farage and company were influenced. It looks as though this insurance magnate, Arron Banks, was laundering money from Russia. I believe his wife is Russian and may well have connections to the FSB. Has he left the country, by the way, Arron Banks? What's the latest on him? He was the biggest.
No, I don't think so. I think he's around.
He's around.
He may come and go, but
right.
I don't think he's in any sense. He's left. He occasionally gives interviews and
right.
he's around, and as is Nigel Farage. I mean, it's quite plain that there was interference in the referendum campaign by probably Russian agents of one kind or another on social media. How much effect it has, we'll probably never know. It's difficult to tell, isn't it, in the close election, as, right. as with your last election, to what extent unseen hands in social media are influencing people. Certainly it went on. Certainly there was almost certainly dirty money was poured into this campaign, and there, you know, Aaron Banks has been fined for some of that misbehaviour with money during the campaign. It would be hard to say, put your hand on your heart and say, the other side would have won had it not been for that. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things you never know. Could have been even closer.
Well, I think Banks was the biggest donor, was he not, to Brexit?
He was. Yeah. Indeed, he was. But there was lots of money swishing about sure. in that campaign.
So,
he had plenty of money on that side.
Right. And just in closing, he showed up a few days after President Trump was elected in Trump Tower with Nigel Farage to be congratulated by President Trump. So our president also was a cheerleader for Brexit.
So. Yes, indeed. He seems to be a cheerleader for breaking up every kind of international organization. He seems to be a cheerleader for nationalism to break out everywhere. Where that leads one country against another all over the world, I don't know. But everything that has secured our peace for 70 years, the European Union, what better week to think about it than in this week of the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, is a good time to think of what Europe has done for us, what the European Union has done for us, and how insane it is to be leaving it. And perhaps there's just a chance we won't. It's a small chance, but there's just the possibility that there will be a second vote, and people do seem to be changing their mind now that they see that the promises that were made were just not true.
Well, Polly Tornby, I thank you very much for joining us here today. And as much as Theresa May is in trouble, our leader on a daily basis creates a far more mayhem than Theresa May could ever imagine. And just covering the White House is like swallowing a daily dose of doom. So it's a much...
But the difference might be this, that what Trump does may be more undoable. What happens with Brexit may last, you know, right. lasting harm for generations. It seems to me a much more fundamental and constitutional matter than anything Trump has quite done yet. Right.
Well, I was trying to cheer you up, but...
sorry.
Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Polly Toynbee, who's a columnist for The Guardian. She was formerly the BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and Associate Editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. And she's the co-author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. And her latest article at The Guardian is Theresa May's Brexit Deal Solves Nothing. Open warfare is about to begin. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into reports that President Trump is sulking in the White House and lashing out at skittish White House aides while he mulls over who to fire.
Small beside a field of grain.
Ain't no sound but the sound of speed. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip to the sound of the beat. Yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey, gonna get you too.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Chris Whipple, who's a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth behind-the-scenes look at the president's closest advisors from interview with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents, including Rahm Emanuel, Dick Cheney, Leon Panetta, and Don Rumsfeld. He's a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS's News' 60 Minutes and ABC News' Primetime. And Chris Whipple is the writer and executive producer of The Spymasters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Whipple.
Good to be back.
Well, thank you, Chris. And as you know, there's this giant inflated baby Trump that sort of dogs Trump around the world. It apparently showed up in Paris just recently. And he does appear to be sulking, holed up in the White House, not basically doing presidential duties like going to Arlington on Veterans Day, not meeting with the King of Jordan, all the things that one would expect a president to do. Apparently, when he was in Paris, he was very, very ornery, sulking over losing a lot of the races in this election. And he apparently got very upset with his staff over him skipping a visit to a U.S. military cemetery because of the rain. And he was upset about Macron. He felt that he was insulted personally, etc. And he apparently, on the way back, according to reports in the Washington Post and other White House reporters, that he's determined to shake up his staff. So what do you expect in the next few days?
Yeah, you know, that was an extraordinary Washington Post piece, if true. It's a really strange spectacle, isn't it, watching him on this recent trip. Somebody described it as Trump retreating into a cocoon of bitterness. You know, maybe it's not to play armchair psychologist here, but you wonder if the midterm results have something to do with it. The fact that he, you know, he really does get a toxic reception when he's overseas. You may remember that when Richard Nixon was in his final days, at the height of Watergate, he went to Cairo and he was received by adoring crowds, and that really pumped him up. But Trump doesn't get that when he goes overseas. It all combined for a pretty miserable trip, I guess. And I also sometimes wonder if Trump isn't a little bit delusional as well. I mean, when you know it's conceivable that he really had convinced himself that he was going to win the midterms. This is all he knows how to do, is really go to rallies and fire up his troops. And it worked for him in 2016. Maybe he thought it would work this time. Wouldn't surprise me. And therefore, he's in a foul, foul mood.
Well, apparently, according to this Washington Post article that you mentioned, which I'm reading now, on the way back in Air Force One from Paris to Washington, apparently almost all of the staff came into the president's cabin to lobby against the leading contender to replace General Kelly. So that doesn't seem to be even in question, that the chief of staff is going to be booted out. This fellow called Nick Ayers, who's Vice President Pence's chief of staff. And apparently the White House staff has said that his appointment would lower staff morale and trigger an exodus. But the president, because...
Sounds like a great idea, doesn't it?
Well, but Ayers is being championed by Ivanka and Jared Kushner. So what do we know about this guy?
That's the rumor. I don't know that that's true, and I don't know a lot about Nick Ayers, so I want to be fair to the guy. For openers, it seems to me that it is time for a change. It's time for Kelly to go. This has been a really bad marriage between Trump and Kelly, and Kelly, as I'm sure you've heard me say again and again, that he reminds me of Don Regan, who was one of the worst White House chiefs in history under Ronald Reagan, arrogant and imperious and politically inept. And I think Kelly has been all of those things. And I think he's reinforced all of Trump's worst partisan instincts. And I think the midterms are a result of that. So it's time for Kelly to go. As for his replacement, you know, Nick Ayers is obviously a capable guy and he's a smart guy. But his principal qualification here seems to be the fact that he gets along with Donald Trump, that they play nicely, that he schmoozes well with Trump. To me, that's the least important qualification for being White House Chief of Staff, and I think that it's asking a lot of somebody whose previous experience was Chief of Staff to one of the ultimate sycophants, Mike Pence. It's asking a lot for that Chief of Staff to step into the role of White House Chief of Staff and tell Donald Trump what he does not want to hear. That's the most important thing that any White House Chief of Staff can do. Nobody's ever done it with Trump. And I think that it may be mission impossible. That person may not exist who can do that. But Trump's only hope is to find somebody like that. He desperately needs his own version of a James A. Baker III or a Leon Panetta who can tell him hard truths.
Well, it doesn't seem that
this is not a popularity contest.
Right.
That's my point.
Sure, but everybody that's tried to speak truth to power, as they say, has been pretty much driven out of there. The National Security Advisor, Secretary of State. It sounds like it's a pretty difficult job
Well, nobody said it would be easy. But I think, for example, that he needs somebody by all accounts, Mike Pompeo is somebody who can talk sense to Trump. He's a grown-up. He's been around the block. He's smart and he's grounded. And he's got a day job, as we all know.
Right.
So he's not available. But Trump desperately needs somebody like that, whether he knows it or not. He doesn't seem to realize it. But he really needs somebody like that in the chief role, I believe.
But it feels as if there's a total vacuum of professionalism and adult behavior there because he gets rid of the adults. And now his wife's weighing in. It's extraordinary that his wife is deciding who serves on the National Security Council. She's gone after Deputy National Security Advisor Mira Ricardel, who apparently is not a very pleasant person.
And this surprises you, Ian, why? I mean, this is the way this White House has operated. As you know, it's been a broken, dysfunctional White House for a long time. Melania is not the first lady to have some clout or want to have some clout when it comes to personnel. Nancy Reagan was famously the White House personnel director, but she never, ever said anything publicly until she unloaded on Don Regan, years later. She always exercised her influence with Ronnie privately. So you're right. There's no precedent for a first lady, trying to sack a national security official publicly. And it's just yet another new thing in the Trump White House.
So this is apparently some kind of battle that's going on there between Bolton and Mattis. And it seems like Melania has had run-ins or doesn't like Kelly. She doesn't like Mattis. And she wants Bolton's deputy to be fired. And apparently he's all about infighting, and she's apparently a real infighting specialist. So has there been a White House this embroiled in infighting ever? It sounds like...
Yeah, I think, there's never been a White House quite this dysfunctional and ineffective. But there... Certainly, the Reagan White House gave it a run for its money when it comes to internecine warfare. And Jim Baker, who was the chief of staff and, as you know, probably my favorite chief of staff in terms of effectiveness, Baker was the hated pragmatist in the Reagan White House. He was the guy who would not let Reagan be Reagan. All the hard right ideologues came after him with their knives sharpened. But Baker was such a savvy, smooth operator with such good political instincts that he befriended Nancy Reagan and Michael Deaver, who was like a son to Ronald Reagan, the deputy chief. And you'll recall he was the maestro of Reagan's public relations. And as a result, Baker prevailed. I think what's happening now is nobody with Baker's skills in this White House. That goes without saying. But what's happening right now, I think, is that John Bolton is winning the war for influence with John Kelly. It's clear that Trump likes Bolton a lot. And he certainly likes Pompeo a lot as well. And I think that Bolton is gaining power. But he may have gone a bit too far by allowing his deputy to run amok and antagonize the First Lady. That's not a good thing.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, it does seem that a lot of White House reporters and pundits have suggested that what's behind Trump sulking a lot is that he's literally was caught by surprise at how well the Democrats did, and the news gets worse for him every day as more and more Democratic House seats are picked up in these long recounts, which he's suggesting we should go with the election results of the election night. But in general, do you think he's really worried about the fact that they're going to be looking into him now, the Democrats, they'll have subpoena power? Is that what's
making? Yeah, it could very well be. You know, we might be not very far from the day when he's walking around talking to the oil portraits the way Nixon did. That's possible. As I say, I think he might have been delusional about the midterms. Or it could just be a bad, bad week for Trump, from which he recovers. I mean, I think that when he went to France, he was probably also in a state of withdrawal. He was missing the adrenaline fix of all those midterm rallies. He hates the business of governance. He loves campaigning. And so he had a terrible week.
And he loves watching TV. Well, I've always thought that, you know, with all the speculation about whether he'll be taken out of the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket, I've always thought that the most likely thing is that President Trump is going to have his Howard Beale moment, like in the movie Network.
Yeah, which is about to have another run on Broadway.
right.
Bryan Cranston, by the way.
Right. Well, I guess we'll stay tuned then. I thank you for joining us, Chris Whipple.
My pleasure, and always enjoy it. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Chris Whipple, who's a writer, a documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth, behind-the-scenes look at the president's closest advisors from interviews with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the new crop of younger, idealistic Democratic members of Congress might vote for Speaker since they distanced themselves from Nancy Pelosi during the campaign. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, John Lawrence, is a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. And his latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, John. And today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, both were reelected to their positions, which they've held. And Kevin McCarthy is now the minority head of the House. So now it remains to be seen what happens with Nancy Pelosi and a number of Democrats who were elected, of course, ran against her in effect or repudiated her. Seth Moulton from Massachusetts has already sort of laid down a marker against her. Since you know her very well, what's your sense of where things stand?
I think that things now are a little bit different than they were on the campaign trail. I think people are coming into Washington. They are going to be meeting with Mrs. Pelosi, but also with prospective committee chairmen, with the senior members of their delegation, with other members of the leadership. And I think there'll be a different kind of a conversation that takes place about the type of leadership that the party needs going forward on January the 3rd. We're going to go right into some very important legislation, some very important confrontations potentially with the president, with the Senate, which remains, of course, in Republican hands. And I think that increasingly the case will be made to people that this speakership is not an on-the-job training exercise. You need somebody there who is going to be experienced. And I note, incidentally, that Seth Moulton, the Massachusetts congressman that you mentioned, is quoted today in the paper as saying that to be an effective speaker, you have to be very good at the sort of transactional inside politics and understanding. And Pelosi is great at that. So even the critics are saying Pelosi is great at the exact and the precise qualities that are required of a Speaker of the House.
But of the 53 newly elected Democrats, only 7 have said they would definitely vote for Nancy Pelosi. That's according to an analysis by The Fix.
Well, of course, you know, the members rightly are going to wait to come into town and talk about what their needs are, what their aspirations are, what they would like in terms of committee assignments. And it's understandable that many of them who have never met Mrs. Pelosi or met the people who are going to be their colleagues are going to withhold making any public commitment until they've had that opportunity. But they're going to have that opportunity. Today, Mrs. Pelosi met with the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is a group that has some ideas for changing the House rules. She's going to meet with members individually. She sponsored a dinner last night, I believe. And that is the normal process that takes place as people become acclimated to the realities of the Hill and the realities of serving in Congress. And one of those is that you need proven and trusted leadership. You know, one of the things that's very different now, as opposed to the class that I wrote about in my book, the class of 74, these members who are coming into town, they don't have any policy disagreements for the most part with our leadership or with the Democratic Party, as they did in 1974 when the leadership was very conservative and very resistant. This is a leadership that's very much in keeping with the new members on health care, on infrastructure, on the need to reform campaign finance laws, immigration laws. So there's not that kind of resistance. And I think the more they talk to people, the more they'll get to know them and they'll recognize the need for having that kind of proven leadership at the helm.
But John Lawrence, isn't it difficult, though, to expect these new congresspeople who have distanced themselves from Nancy Pelosi during the campaign to take their first vote and vote for her? Wouldn't they get backlash from their constituents? Wouldn't they be out of the gate, the very first vote being a repudiation of their stance?
Well, the first vote will actually be taken in a caucus meeting. And that's where the Democrats will decide who their candidate for speaker is going to be. And that vote is going to occur in late November. So that the speaker vote on the floor won't occur until January. So if there are people who, after these discussions and after these meetings, and remember, they had none of this beforehand when they were talking about these issues on the campaign trail. Now they will have actually met with people who will explain to them what the agenda is going to be, how their organization is going to proceed, where they're going to be located in committees, and lots of issues that they didn't have to deal with as candidates. But if there are some people who disagree after all those conversations, they will certainly have the opportunity to vote against Mrs. Pelosi, just as they said they would on the campaign trail when the Democratic caucus meets. But once the Democratic caucus makes a decision, reaches a decision as to who their candidate is going to be, I think there's some expectation that people then stick with the caucus. I mean, what are they going to do, go to the floor and vote for the Republican?
Right.
You know, that's the Democratic caucus's position. And there are times, not many, but there are times, when you're called upon on procedural votes or key votes to stick with the Democratic caucus because that is in the party's interest and that's what the majority of your colleagues have agreed to do. So they will have a chance to vote against her if they want, but once the caucus makes that decision, if that decision is for Mrs. Pelosi, I would expect most of those members would then ratify the Democratic caucus's point of view, because it's at that point it's ratifying the caucus. It's not simply their own personal perspective.
But a recent poll by Monmouth finds that just under 3 in 10 Democrats approve of Pelosi's job performance as the party's minority leader in the House. So how is that going to affect the representatives if the grassroots, if you will, are opposed to Pelosi? And I don't know how much they're opposed based upon the relentless attacks on her by the Republicans. It's hard to know, but that's not a good sign, is it? Only 3 in 10 Democrats approving of her performance?
Well, I guess a couple of points. Number one, you mentioned at the top that Senator McConnell and Senator Schumer were just reelected. I think their popularity is actually lower than Mrs. Pelosi's, certainly right around the same level. I think part of the problem here is that most voters don't really know a great deal about what the actual members do and what the actual leaders do. And so they're very heavily influenced by what others say. You know, the Republicans have spent over a decade, have run over 100,000 negative campaign commercials and tens of millions of dollars castigating Mrs. Pelosi. I don't think Mrs. Pelosi's run a single ad supporting her. So naturally, I don't think it's terribly surprising that public opinion would be weighted in that particular direction. I think it's much more significant that independent analysts who look at the Congress, people like Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, is a very highly respected political scientist, say that she is the most effective speaker that we've had in the last 75 years. And as I say, even Seth Moulton said she's really great at the exact job that she's being called upon to serve as a Speaker of the House. So I think that those, you know, people who really pay close attention, even critics, acknowledge her enormous success in passing laws like the health care law and passing laws like reining in Wall Street abuses and saving the economy from collapse and providing jobs through the stimulus. Those folks who have followed her career are very aware of this seminal role and the leadership role that she has played as Speaker.
And what role is age playing in this, given that Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn are all in their 70s and they've been leading the caucus for more than 15 years? And as far as I know, there aren't any succession plans, and that would seem to be something that the Democrats should be addressing.
Well, in point of fact, if you look beneath those three positions, and actually there is a challenge to Mr. Clyburn for the whip position, there's a whole litany, there are 7 or 8 additional leadership positions, the caucus chair, the caucus vice chair, the assistant leader, the campaign chair, the campaign messaging chair, the new members representative on the leadership. All of those positions are up for election as well. All of them are being contested, and almost everybody who's on that list of contestants is a junior member, 4 terms, 5 terms at the most. So there is a succession. It is not a succession that the speaker or the leader determines. She or he does not decide who the next person in line is. The caucus does. The caucus votes for these positions. So the Democratic speaker, the Democratic leader, doesn't choose her successor any more than the outgoing president chooses the nominee of the party. That doesn't work that way. It's up to the caucus. But I think what people can be confident about is that next generation of people, and Mrs. Pelosi has talked about her speakership, her forthcoming speakership, as a transitional one. that next generation is going to be in place. It's going to be voted on in the next 2 weeks. And I think it will be very clear by the time you get to January 3rd, when the speaker decision is made, that there is a new generation of Democratic leaders ready to take up the responsibilities when this current group is finished.
So let's talk about your new book, John Lawrence, The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. When you talk about the roots of partisanship, and of course a lot of people are making comparisons to this blue wave election, which is a sort of blue wave that looked like a bit of a ripple, but now it's actually turned into a wave, and every day we find out more.
Every day, yeah.
More and more. There's just a couple here in Orange County that have looks like the Democrats have picked up seats.
Yes.
And there's a very good article recently by McKay Coppins, I think, in The Atlantic, about Newt Gingrich, the title of which is The Man Who Broke Politics. And he basically pins the beginning of this rabid partisanship and tribalism, as it's called now, in our politics. He traces it to Newt Gingrich, who deliberately blew up the comity that existed back in those days when Republicans and Democrats knew each other, their wives knew each other, they had dinners together, they played golf together, etc. So in that context, how much do you feel that the class of 74 contributed to, as you say in the title, subtitle, Roots of Partisanship?
Yeah, I think my argument is less that the class caused or contributed to it, but that the reforms that were implemented with the support of the class of 74, which basically decentralized power in Congress and gave greater ability for individual members and subcommittees to participate, created a Congress that was less leadership dominated, also opened opportunities for what were emerging divisions in American society, in American culture, in American politics, in American financial interests with respect to campaign financing, to take root and to force debates that formerly had been largely suppressed, were now given opportunities to get into the House and the Senate and become very, very contentious issues. I think that the argument that was made about Gingrich puts the onset of partisanship probably a decade and a half later than it really is. You have to look, as my book does, to the mid-1970s, when you have very significant divisions occurring, partly as a result of the growth of the Republican Party in the South following the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in the mid-60s, really changing demographics, the emergence of independent money, the rise of new technologies that allow for ideologically based media and press coverage that really force people in what political scientists say into realignment. The Democrats become more liberal, the Republicans be more conservative, and as they say in Texas, there's not much left in the middle of the road other than a yellow line and a dead armadillo. But that process really begins back in the 1970s. Gingrich is very good at throwing gasoline into the fire, and he certainly exacerbates this problem with his emphasis on divisive language and lack of compromise, because he sees the possibility of Republicans gaining the majority, but only if people clearly differentiate Republicans from Democrats, and he sets about to do that by demonizing Democrats. Democrats provide him with some good ammunition for doing that, and by the late 1980s, that is where our politics has gone. But if you look to that later period, without really seeing how these issues and these trends emerged in the 70s, you're missing an important part of the story, which is what I try to tell in this book.
So just back to the comparisons of this being like the class of 74 in terms of a huge influx of young and largely progressive Democrats, how is Nancy Pelosi going to navigate this concern that she clearly has that she doesn't want the new Democratic House right out of the gate talking about impeachment? She feels, well, I can tell, that the Democrats have to prove to the American people that they're not the wrecking crew, but they have a positive agenda. And obviously, fundamentally, the fact that they got elected would indicate that the American people want a check and balance on Trump, because the Republican House and Senate have been completely derelict in exercising their constitutional powers as a separate branch of... They've been the enablers of the wrecking crew, to put it bluntly.
I don't think there's any question that you're exactly right. The Congress has literally failed in its responsibility both to legislate and therefore enabling the president to impose sweeping policy changes through executive actions. And then they failed to conduct adequate oversight, which is their constitutional responsibility, to investigate how those decisions were made and whether or not they're in keeping with the spirit and the letter of the law. So they failed on both accounts. I think that impeachment is going to probably be off the table in the same way that Mrs. Pelosi took it off the table when she became Speaker in 2007. There were a lot of people at that point, for example, who wanted her to initiate impeachment hearings of President Bush over the decision to go to war in Iraq. And she made the case that we had more important priorities than that. And she set about dealing with the economy and dealing with energy policy and dealing with health care and others. I think this time the incoming class, interestingly, ran very much on issues that speak to traditional Democratic policy objectives: health care, protecting Social Security, Medicare, fixing the DREAM Act and the DACA students and immigration, addressing climate change, fixing the Voting Rights Act. These are these incoming members from urban, suburban districts, moderate districts, liberal districts, they all pretty much agree on those issues. And I think Mrs. Pelosi will recognize, and I think most Democrats will recognize, that voters sent people to Washington to deal with those issues and not to become bogged down in partisan fighting. Having said that, I think that Democrats will simultaneously begin serious investigations and oversights, not necessarily into the impeachment question, but into questions of how did the president make decisions to weaken the Affordable Care Act, to expand the amount of mercury that could be released into the air and into the water, to weaken mileage standards, to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, and a host of other executive-level decisions that he has been able to make and that the Congress has not batted an eye about. Now I think those people who made those decisions, whether it's in EPA or whether it's in the Department of Health and Human Services or in the White House, for that matter, are going to be called to the Congress, and they're going to be asked to produce the information and the data that justifies these really sweeping changes in policy that the Congress has never voted on and that the Congress has never investigated. And if those officials of the Trump administration refuse to produce that information, then you'll be looking at subpoenas, and properly so. They don't have the authority to simply tell Congress they won't produce that information. But I don't think that'll be the first line of inquiry. I think they will first meet with people, tell them, we want to see, come down, we want to see where your information comes from on all these radical changes that the president has been able to make on public laws, and hopefully hold them accountable for those kinds of decisions.
Well, John Lawrence, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Pleasure to talk with you, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. And his latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.